Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We have a lot to talk about in the course of this hour. We're about to have a conversation with Chris Hedges, former reporter of the New York Times. But first, we want to remember somebody who passed away. She's been a guest on the show. My producer, Justin Levy, met with her when he went to West Virginia for our series on West Virginia a few years back. And Julia Bonds, was executive director of Coal River Mountain Watch. And she was an amazing woman who fought to save her people and Appalachia from destruction of mountaintop removal and a way of life and the cancer that swept through that world because of the mining that was done and because of how they destroyed and laid waste. Years ago, she wanted to have a 1,000 hillbilly march, she called it, onto Washington, D.C., and actually, in this last year, that came to pass with Appalachia Rising, even though the press didn't cover it. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people from Appalachia, activists and others, marched on Washington, D.C. to stop mountaintop removal and to build a new America. And she was an amazing woman who had her life threatened, was beaten, was jailed to fight for her people. And the place where she lived, in the hollows of West Virginia, was right next to this Massey Energy. Remember them, that they were fined for everything you can imagine. All those miners were killed in the Massey Energy mine. They had a place near hers where they were doing mountaintop removal in Marfork Holler, where she lived. And the toxic dust, airborne dust, caused cancer across that part of the mountains of West Virginia that led to cancer to many people and into Judy Bonds' life, lungs, heart, and body. And it took its toll, but she fought to the end. She was an icon, leader, an inspiration, and a friend to many, and a fighter for human rights. And we remember her today as she passed on. She was the leader of Coal River Mountain Watch, and we were honored to be able to have her voice in these airwaves. And right now we're going to just give you a short presentation from a clip of an interview we had with Judy Bonds.
While today in America, in the land of the free, Appalachia is still considered a throwaway zone. The mountaineer, or the hillbilly, is still considered a second-class citizen and disposable. And to my own heartbreak, some within our own states feel this way as well. They only want the coal that they rip from our land for their own personal energy. The Appalachians is the only ethnic group left that America can still make fun of and get by with it. The only one left. America still rapes the land and the people of Appalachia and doesn't think twice about it. Government agencies still holds contempt for us Appalachians. They want us extinct. They want us to go away. Mountaineers are always free, and that's something we must always remember. And we must remember why we're always free. The best way to destroy mountaineers and hillbillies is to destroy their habitat, the very essence of who we are. Destroy the mountain, and so goes the mountaineer. When the mountains and the mountain cultures are gone, who will we be? Our culture and our dialect will be forgotten. But we're fighting back. We were born fighting, as Senator Webb puts it. But it seems as if some people don't want us around unless there's a good fight or unless they need us to fight their wars. Then they want us.
She passed away, Judy Bonds, and she was a fighter who fought for not just the rights of the miners and the people who lived in Appalachia, but for all of people who believe in a different kind of society in this country. And so we mourn her passing and remember her. As we remember how to fight for a better America, she was one of the great heroes, and she passed away in the last day. We are joined now by Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is he's not there yet. All right, let's get him on the phone here. We'll get him. We're about to talk to Chris Hedges, and Chris Hedges is a writer, professor, and activist, senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City, former New York Times foreign correspondent for 15 years. He has written a book called Death of the Liberal Class, he's actually nice. Let's switch gears for a minute and go somewhere else together while we're waiting for him, and we'll get him on the air as soon as he gets here, as soon as he gets back, as soon as we get through to him. His line is busy in New York, and as soon as we get him, we'll have him on. You all can join me here, 410-319-8888, while we're waiting and talk about, for the next few minutes, whatever's on your mind and what has been going on in the news of late. One of the things that I had a conversation the other night with a very dear friend, Sherrilyn Ifill, actually, and we were talking about this last election that took place where Pat Jessamy lost to Greg Bernstein. While people can have a lot of critiques of Pat Jessamy and how she ran that office, and I was one of those who did over the years, Baltimore has seen the lowest crime shooting rate and murder rate in over 22 years. You know, usually when that happens, as she pointed out to me, that the mayor, the police commissioner, and the state's attorney all take credit for that, or they're given some credit for the drop in the crime rate. But it was made to seem that the city was out of control, and I suppose it was made to seem the city was out of control because the sad death of a Johns Hopkins student made headlines and made people think they were unsafe. That's part of what led to her downfall and the powers to be who didn't want her there anymore. So she lost. I'm curious what you all think about that. And let's talk about that and the politics coming up and the election coming up for mayor and more. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And there's just a lot. Greg Bernstein may do a great job as state's attorney, and we're looking forward to having him on to talk about his plans once he gets into office. Well, he's in office because he was sworn in just an hour ago in downtown Baltimore. So I'm curious what you all think. 410-319-8888. Pat Jessamy ran. She lost. She was state's attorney here for many, many years. It was an election that was was fraught with all kinds of arguments about race in America and race in this society here and how that played a role in all of this. And I am very curious as to your thoughts on that at 410-319-8888. And one of the things we'll be talking in the next hour with Lester Spence is about the progressives who are taking on Barack Obama and what would happen if there was a split in the progressive movement because somebody ran against Barack Obama who from the progressive on the left liberal side and what that might do in terms of a racial divide between black and white progressives and people in this country who want a better America. We'll be doing a lot of that in the next hour with our guest Lester Spence. But let's go to the phones here and see what people think. 410-319-8888. Stefan in Northwest Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Yeah, good, Stefan. How are you? Welcome.
All right. I think this is my opinion. I think it's the books, the crime books. I think that they cook those books up because I don't think that the crime is bad, but it's not that bad. But I think they just cook those books, and I just hope and pray that this should be a good year because, in my opinion, I think. Barack Obama is part of that new world order, that Boulay society they're talking about during the 60s. That's what I think. That's my opinion. That's all I got to say.
All right. Thank you. No, I appreciate it. Appreciate it. I'd like to hear what everybody thinks out there. 410-319-8888. I mean, I think that in certain communities within our community, in the poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore, threat of violence is always there. But let's hear what you think about what happened this last election. And Diane, you're on the air.
To you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
I just want to say that a lot of people didn't really do their research. I don't care what section of Baltimore you lived in. They really didn't do their research. They went on what one of the lawyers, a prominent lawyer in Baltimore, was saying about Patricia Jessamy, and he was saying that she wasn't doing her job. She didn't do her job, but she really actually really did her job. And the other thing is the people that live in the communities, they want to feel safe, too, and they tell the police, you know, are you going to, you know, make me safe because you didn't protect the Dorsons family? So that's why people don't really relate to the police because they felt that they didn't protect the Dorsons family, and people didn't do their research to find out that she really did. She shouldn't have got fired because if the crime was down, she's supposed to reward that that state's attorney. Most of the time, and then we had so many conflicts with the mayor's office, you know, leaving Mayor Dixon the way she left, and then Miss Stephanie Rollins came in. That was, you know, that was another thing. And then we lost Commissioner Hamm in that process. All of that was in the same, you know, it wasn't in the same year, but a few years, we lost Hamm. And that was, crime was going down when he was there. But, you know, people just see what they see and read what they see in the paper and still are doing their research, and they should do their research. And they would have found out crime, you know, if they say crime was really down, then she should have been awarded, not let go.
I'm glad you shared your thoughts. And I think that, I mean, one of the things is she also ran afoul of the establishment, always taking on the police department. And I think there was a real divide about that. And I'll be honest. I mean, over the years, Pat Chesney's been a guest on the show many, many times. And she was, I had my critiques about how she ran the department internally and my critiques about her not standing up for the, mostly Black men who were arrested for nonviolent crimes who languished in jail for months and months waiting for court to come up. And I think she failed on that line. But the issues were larger than that, I think, in the sense that the attacks on this fear of crime in the city have proven to be unfounded. And I think it's something for us to reflect on. I appreciate your thoughts on that, Diane. And let's go to Linda in Catonsville. You're on the air.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And, you know, I really think that there should be an investigation on the people who are truly, you know, that truly have the last say. Some of the judges need to be investigated because this, a lot of the crimes that are being committed, these shootings and murders, are the same. People are being turned loose over and over again to commit the same crimes. And it seems to be a very big problem because some of the people that have committed these some of these murders should have never even been on the street. So it's time to take a real deep look at the real cause of the problem. I want the killing and all that craziness to stop in the name of Jesus because nobody deserves to die in cold blood. And we all, I remember years ago when everybody was family. You didn't have to lock your doors. Every neighbor knew what was, you know, what was needed. If their neighbor was in need of something, they, you know, we shared all this robbing and killing. I remember when when our men used to run a lady down if they saw her carrying a bag, not to rob her, but to help her. Because it was a matter of respect, but like I said, we need to come together as a nation and go to the root of the problem and stop trying to blame the, you know, put the blame on, you know, one person or one thing or the other.
Linda, I appreciate the call, and I think that that times have changed like that, and I think that that poverty has grown, dislocation has grown. And I think that we do lay this on the top of one woman's head, and that was just an absurdity of the last election. We're going to, and I appreciate you being part of the show and calling in, Linda, with your ideas. We're going to switch gears here. Our guest, who has written the book Death of the Liberal Class, a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, who was a former New York Times correspondent for 15 years, a fluent Arabic speaker who was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team, Chris Hedges, joins us on the phone by phone right now. And, Chris, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So this is I'm glad you could join us for a bit here. I've been looking forward to this for a while. So even though we have a short time of the day, I'm going to force you to come back a little later for a longer time.
Yeah, sure.
But let's talk about this notion of death of the liberal class. We have a lot of debates here on this program about the question of liberal, progressive, and what we mean by the death of a liberal. What do you mean by the death of a liberal class?
Those traditional liberal institutions that watched out for the interests of those outside of the narrow power elite, the press, liberal religious institutions, culture to a certain extent, public education, in particular public universities, labor, and the Democratic Party. And all of them have walked away from working men and women.
And what do you mean they've walked away?
Well, they no longer, self-identified liberals within the society, no longer champion the interests of the poor and the working class. Or even the middle class. So within the political structure, and I think this was accelerated in particular by Bill Clinton, you have figures who purport to care about liberal values, speak about those values. Barack Obama would be another, and yet carry out policies that continue the corporate dismantling of both institutions and protections that, that once made this country, if not you know, any kind of an egalitarian state, at least one where the grossest injustices and grievances had a kind of mechanism by which they could be heard and by which piecemeal or incremental reform could be carried out. I mean, the classic example would be the New Deal policies of the 1930s. You had massive suffering and deprivation on the part of tens of millions of Americans. And let's not be naive. It wasn't Roosevelt who gave the New Deal to us. It was the auto workers who carried out the sit-down strikes and the bonus markers. We had very powerful populist movements that pressured the liberal class to act. Now the liberal class has become essentially courtiers to corporations, whether within the universities, within the press, certainly within the Democratic Party, and the voices and suffering and injustices and grievances of working men and women in this country have nowhere to go. No, they're not heard, and they're certainly not. These injustices are not rectified. So you have absurd situations where the so-called jobs bill, for instance, ends up being $15 billion in tax credits for corporations. The Obama administration has not restored habeas corpus. He's reneged almost every campaign promise that he made, including the public option. Remember that this year he promised to raise minimum wage to $9.50 an hour. Let's wait and see if that's going to happen. And what we have undergone is a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion by corporations, and the corporations have won and we've lost.
Now, I'm curious. It's kind of combining things here, but I want you to describe the slow motion coup d'état from your perspective. I mean, a lot of people have argued that we've seen the corporatization of our country, the absolute takeover of our Congress and every part of our life by the corporate world, as opposed to by us, the people.
Well, we have. I mean, they write the legislation. They wrote the health care bill, all 2,000 pages of it, so-called health care bill, which just becomes the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for-profit pharmaceuticals and insurance companies, $400 billion in taxpayer subsidies. The things that these look, people who make profit, corporations shouldn't be allowed anywhere near a health care system. It is legally permitted in this country to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's what we're talking about. 45,000 Americans died last year because they couldn't get proper medical care. It's obscene. And this has just been replicated across the landscape. We're destroying public education. It reinforces a kind of classism. We educate the elite. If you have $30,000, $40,000, you can send your son or daughter to a private high school. But if you don't, you're watching your school get decimated, especially in the inner cities. And we are just reeling backwards. The civil rights movement being a classic example. For the upper third of African Americans, people like Michelle and Barack Obama, they were integrated into the power elite. But for the bottom two thirds of African Americans in this country, things are worse. As Dr. King and Malcolm and everybody understood, you can't talk about racial justice if you can't talk about economic justice. And Clinton accelerated this. Clinton knew, on purpose. Clinton understood that if he did corporate bidding, he would get corporate money. And so he pushed through NAFTA, which was a huge betrayal of the working class in this country. It allowed us to dismantle our manufacturing sector, send it to Mexico, China, Vietnam, the Philippines, and then telling American workers that they have to be competitive on a global marketplace, in essence being competitive with slave labor. It was Clinton that deregulated the banking system. Canada doesn't have a banking crisis because they didn't allow their commercial banks to become hedge funds. And all of the people that carried out this kind of deregulation, Geithner, Larry Summers, they all came back into the Obama administration to serve corporate interests. And look, the name being floated around for Obama's new chief of staff is the CEO of J.P. Morgan. It's criminal. And liberal institutions, which of course were always complicit with the power elite, and were kept honest by radical movements, by pressure from radical movements. And let's be clear, King was a radical. The civil rights movement was a radical movement. It relied on the support of northern white liberals. But once King confronted the racism in the North, and in 1967 when he directly took on the Vietnam War, most of these liberals walked out on him, including Lyndon Johnson, who withdrew the four plainclothes FBI agents who had protected King. And both King and Johnson knew what that meant, or would mean. A year later.
Let me ask you a personal question in a sojourn that comes to fruition in some ways in this new book that you've written. I mean, you were a reporter for a long time, and you covered El Salvador. You went and studied Arabic, and you covered the Middle East for the New York Times, Jerusalem and Cairo and in Kosovo and across. And you're a Nieman Fellow, and you've done lots of things like that in the course of your life working. I'm curious what happened to Chris Hedges in those 15, 20 years you're doing this work, and the place you've come to now, and the transformation that took place for you that led you to the place you're in now?
Well, you can't live on the outer edges of empire and watch what we do to other people and not be moved and disturbed by it. I've been in Gaza when it's been bombed by American F-16s piloted by Israelis. I've seen what we do to Palestinians. I covered the Contra war in Nicaragua. I was in El Salvador when Reagan was backing a government that harbored death squads that were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month. You can't see that kind of stuff and not be affected by it. I was in Sarajevo during the war in Bosnia. So, it's a series of confrontations with empire and understanding our role in the world and the hypocrisy that we practice, the violence that we practice on others, especially the weak, it is bound to change you. And coming back to the United States after 2 decades and getting up and speaking those kinds of truths made me a pariah within the newsroom of the New York Times is not surprising.
You were asked as a gilt paper to tone yourself down, and you didn't.
Well, I was denouncing the Iraq war, the build-up to the war in Iraq, and, I was given a formal written reprimand, which the process is they give you the written reprimand, and the next time you speak out, you're fired. So at that point, I had a choice. I could muzzle myself in service to my career, or I could quit, and I quit.
Now, in today's opednews.com, you wrote a piece that I read just before I'm on the air, and you had this conversation with Ralph Nader, who's been a guest on the show many times over the weekend. And it was a pretty stunning article, really, in terms of a story, in terms of what he's saying about where we are. And I'm curious just to describe that a bit and talk about what you think we have to do. I mean, the piece you wrote about the labor unions was really very telling in that short piece that you wrote about Ralph Nader in your conversation with him, because in your former newspaper, the New York Times this morning, the right-hand column was a column about how public unions are being decimated around the country and being attacked. So there was a really interesting juxtaposition there.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're doing quite effectively. And they say to taxpayers, well, look at these unions, because it's the last readout of union activity, although they're bizarre unions because most of them can't strike. And they're saying to taxpayers, look, these people have benefits and job protection and salaries you don't have, the non-unionized working and middle class. Why should you do it? It's quite a pernicious ploy on the part of the elite, and it works. Instead, of course, it's the wrong question. The question should be, why don't we have those kinds of benefits and protections? Why aren't our middle and working class people unionized so that they can have a decent standard of living? Cuomo's began the war today. I live in New Jersey, and the Governor Christie is working overtime to dismantle the teachers' union. So the last, they are creating a neo-feudalistic society, a world of masters and serfs. And people are very short-sighted. Yes, there are problems with the unions. Yes, you know, a lot of these guys are bloated, pulling down $500,000 a year. Their benefits are six times what their rank and file make. I mean, I'm not denying all that, which is, of course, why they're politically so passive. The leadership's been bought off. But the fact is unions created the middle class in this country. There was no middle class before unions. People need to go back and look at what this country was like on the eve of industrialization at the turn of the century. And it was the militant unions, the Wobblies, the old CIO, the communists, the socialists, not the liberal class, who fought and in many cases died so that working men and women in this country could live lives with dignity and self-respect and a kind of justice within American capitalism. All of that has been, and the last vestiges of it are, being ruthlessly dismantled by a corporate state that is serviced by both the Republican and the Democratic Party. The bottom line is there is no way left to either vote or fight back against Goldman Sachs. They run everything.
So now Eric Alterman has written a new book. In Eric Alterman's book, he maintains, and he'll be coming on the show soon, he maintains that the only thing people who are on the progressive side of America can do is elect a Barack Obama who spoke about hope in the campaign. But because of the way the system is built at the moment and the power and control of corporations, you can't get beyond that. The way the system is
in... Yeah, you have to step out. The system doesn't work. It's a corporate system. We have to step outside the system. Everything we do has to be an act of defiance.
What does that mean? I've seen you say that many times. I know you were arrested along with Margaret Flowers and others.
Yeah.
Who's been
okay. I mean, that's one thing. But I didn't vote for Obama. I voted for Nader.
Uh-huh.
And people should have voted for Nader or voted for McKinney. You know, we've got at what point do we stand up and stop them from wiping their feet all over our faces? We have to give up on the politics of the practical and stand for those moral imperatives. All of the great correctives to American democracy never came from movements or people who achieved formal positions of power. It came from the Liberty Party that fought slavery. It came from the suffragists who fought for women's rights. It came from the labor movement, the civil rights movement. I mean, the most powerful political figure, if you want, in 1968 in this country was Martin Luther King. Because when he went to Birmingham or Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And that's what we need to do. And it's not accidental, I believe, that King came out of the church. That for King, there were moral imperatives that he would not compromise on, and justice being foremost among them. And we have to recover that language and recover that sense of self-respect and recover that fortitude to stand up for these moral imperatives against corporate forces that are hollowing this country out from the inside, because if we don't, we're going to end up in a system of corporate slavery.
As you paint, a Huxleyan and Orwellian future awaits us, is what you think could happen.
Well, we started with Huxley, but there's no more credit. People can't afford even to own their own home, you know, to pay their mortgages on their homes. They can't pay their health care bills. They can't pay for these private colleges. Kids are graduating with staggering sums of debt. These jobs that we lost are not coming back, which Lawrence Summers tacitly admits when he talks about a jobless recovery. So we'll go from Huxley, which is buying you off and amusing you with spectacle and entertainment, to Orwell, which is the surveillance and the security state. And if you doubt me, walk down any street in your city.
But we have both. We have both.
We have most people are kept passive through credit, through entertainment, and through cheap manufactured goods in China. But it's not working anymore. That's breaking down. And when that breaks down, then we become a much more overtly totalitarian society. So we have the system, has already been set up to move seamlessly from Huxley to Orwell. Because if people become restive, the capacity for control by the state, and you know, anyone, I was in Pittsburgh for the G20, you could have been in Toronto, is terrifying. Every group was infiltrated. Websites were crashed. The anarchists showed up in Pittsburgh with a bus. You know, a few hours later, got impounded. Every time they tried to have an action, it never came off. They were always busted up an hour before. This is really remarkable.
So where do you think we go now? I mean, what do you think happens at this moment? So
physical acts of resistance, stepping outside the mainstream, becoming as self-sustaining as we can, because as things deteriorate, the corporate state, the corporate elite will withdraw behind gated communities and take care of themselves. And you already see it. I mean, in inner cities, they're food deserts. It's like this crazy system set up where I live in New Jersey and all my fruits and vegetables come from California. Well, if you're poor, and I just did an article on Camden, New Jersey, which
per capita
is the poorest city in the country, you can't afford tomatoes from California. So they don't have any tomatoes. There's no supermarket in the center of Camden. You eat donuts or Church's fried chicken. That's it. And these post-industrial, blighted, apocalyptic pockets are just going to leach outwards so that you have an oligarchic class that lives with absurd luxury. I mean, CEOs, the major CEOs on Wall Street are pulling down $900,000 an hour, and the rest of us. And that's where we're headed. And either we stand up and physically begin to defy it and fight back, or we're doomed because the formal mechanisms of power serve these corporate interests, not the citizenry.
I wonder if you think that, I mean, when you talk about the acts of defiance, I mean, the difference between now and, let's say, 1963 or 1962 or 1936 is that at the moment there were movements that took place.
Yeah, that's precisely the problem. They have dismantled the radical movements that kept the liberal class honest. The liberal class was responding to these movements. So the movements have been wiped out. The Wobblies, the old CIO, the communists, the socialists, anarchists, they're gone. And the liberal class itself function as courtiers to the power elite. Look at the press. So that's really dangerous because we don't have the mechanisms by which to fight back. So you can find a kind of inchoate rage that builds up. But if it's not organized, then it's easily snuffed out.
Chris, I really appreciate you being part of the show today, and I look forward to you coming on for a longer discussion.
I will come back anytime you want.
And I think that what you're saying is important for us to wrestle with here, and there's a lot of what the theme of this next hour and a half in the show will be that. And I appreciate you taking the time with all of our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Hedges, his book, Death of the Liberal Class, you can connect to it at steinershow.org, and we will have him back. Thanks so much for the work you put out. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back and talk then with the minority House leader, Congressman Steny Hoyer from Maryland's 5th District, will be with us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Then we'll be talking with Congresswoman Donna Edwards. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. The number here is...